Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 4th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Dirty Theology, Reaffirming the Christian Earth Care Tradition, Session 4, July 4th Special, America the Beautiful. It is presented by Paul Santmeier. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming to this July 4th special. This is in the midst of an unfolding set of discussions that began talking about the ecological complaint against Christianity, reviewing some insights from the Bible on nature and questions of humans' rightful place in nature, and then looking yesterday at some larger questions about the meaning of Jesus Christ set in the context of the whole cosmos. Let me just put in a plug for tomorrow. Tomorrow we will return to the sequence that we've been working on in these sessions at 10:45 in the morning. This overall session, for those of you who just came in, the overall sequence has been, I've been calling Dirty Theology, reaffirming the Christian Earth Care Tradition. And tomorrow at 10:45, I'm going to start a discussion off from Dirty Theology to Dirty Ethics, Working Principles for Earth Care. So that's where this session will go tomorrow. But today is a thing in itself, although related, because at the end, I hope we, in the course of discussion, can come up with a theological vision for America, and hopefully to draw on some of the things that we've talked about in previous discussions and lead into tomorrow's discussion. Today, the July 4th special is either one of these titles, America the Beautiful or America the Beautiful. And I hope we can engage this discussion in mid-course of this hour and really dig a little more deeply into American culture and then try to justify whatever we're going to conclude, whether it's America the Beautiful or America the Beautiful. Just let me, I will spare you my singing of this, but unless you all want to sing it. Oh, beautiful. Do you all want to sing it? Do you know the words?
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesty,
class or what?
Yeah.
Then for those of you who might be of a somewhat later generation, we may or may not want to sing this one, but this land is your land. This land is mine. Who wants to start that one?
Yep.
Go ahead. This land is my land, from California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Okay, that's sort of an updated America the Beautiful. This land is my land. This land is your land. God gave it to us for a possession. Maybe. Okay, that's where we're beginning, and I want to go back to some of the roots of America the Beautiful, and this land is your land, this land is my land. Just with some sort of walking lightly through American cultural history, beginning with your favorite friends from Thanksgiving time, the Pilgrims. Now, I won't go into who really discovered America. Those of you who were yesterday heard me tell this story of Dick Gregory. I'll do it again. Dick Gregory said at one point, when raised the question of who discovered America, and of course, everyone said Columbus, he said, gee, I wonder who those people were waving at Columbus when he came in. Yeah. Who discovered America?
Yeah.
Well, we think the Pilgrims set things going, and in many ways they did for our dominant culture in this country. The Pilgrims came with a vision, many of them, that they had left behind Egypt. They had left that land of corruption, Europe, and they were going through the Red Sea waters across the Atlantic, and the Lord brought them through those waters and gave them the Promised Land. And in this Promised Land, the Pilgrims wanted to establish a new Eden, a peaceable kingdom. Some of you, how many have seen the folk painting by Edward Hicks, The Peaceable Kingdom with the animals?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone has seen that. And Hicks in the early 18th century, 19th century, he painted like 300 of those paintings, and they're all over the place. So the Pilgrims came with this vision, inspired by the Bible, that this land is given to them. The land in which you are entering, the Lord God has given you to possess. Yes, there was a darker side to this, because what did the Israelites do when they entered the land of Canaan? They took the land, but they took it from somebody. They threw out the Canaanites. So there's a darker side to this entrance into the new Eden, but that's the way the Puritans thought of themselves, as coming into a new Eden, where they would then establish a society of purity, away from all the corruptions of monarchy and wealth and so forth from the old world. Now, what immediately began to catch up, of course, is that corruptions immediately happened in this new Eden. And so there's constantly been a drive to go away from where the corruptions. Well, it's where people gather, so you want to go out further into the wilderness. And a number of so-called utopian communities in American history did precisely that. They went out further. I mean, the Mormons are one example, to get away and establish this new holy community in the wilderness. And a lot of academic institutions, you may indeed have gone to one of the colleges that was established to get away from those European corruptions. They immediately started coming into Boston and New York and other places like that, so people wanted to get further west, build academic institutions, build church institutions, build social institutions that more reflected the new Eden, the peaceable kingdom that they had come to live in and to establish. Now, in the midst of this movement to be the new Adam and the new Eve in a new world, some didn't move away, literally move away. Some did a kind of a psychological migration, and one of these, although not completely psychological, it was also somewhat geographical, was Henry David Thoreau. And in my sort of untutored reading of American history, Henry David Thoreau is a key figure. Just let me check in with you guys. How many of at least have ever held in your hand a copy of Walden? Not that you've read it, but that you have held in your hand. So you know something about Thoreau. Thoreau stayed at home, yet at the same time, this vision of the purity of life and nature in this new and beautiful land very much informed what he was doing. He was a person in the early 19th century of great moral conscience. And if you haven't held Thoreau's book Walden in your hand, you probably at some place in high school or some other place read his essay on civil disobedience, that he stood up against slavery. He was radically opposed to slavery, and for that we can only salute him. Yet at the same time, his radical critique of slavery was accompanied with a motion to disengage himself from society. Yes, opposed to slavery, but the tendency was to step back from this corrupt society, and eventually then, he, as an exemplary move, he took up residence in Walden. He began to celebrate the virtues of small-town America over against the big cities and the corruptions that that he saw there, of power corruptions and others, above all, slavery. He remarked at one point that there is more wisdom in Boxborough than in New York and Boston put together. There's something about the person who's close to the land, the person who lives at the edge of the wilderness, that provides a kind of wisdom that city folks don't have. City folks tend to get corrupted by power. Most famously, he went off to live in Walden. How many of you have ever visited Walden? It's like a pond, isn't it, with trees around it?
It is. It's a beautiful lake. It's go out there and walk around.
Yeah, you still can do that. It was a struggle to save it from development, but it's, at least it's not quite so filled with development as used to be and the garbage that went with it. And Thoreau, for those of you who have walked with this guy, is an immensely perceptive writer when it comes to nature. He would take the time to be accustomed to the rhythms of nature. He would get acquainted with the woodchuck, so to speak. As an aside, I don't like woodchucks. They eat my coal plants in the garden, and I would love to shoot them, but I don't allow myself to have a gun. But anyway, Thoreau loved to encounter woodchucks and all the creatures of nature. He once said in Walden that, and you can see how once he gets in the context of what he imagines to be primeval spaces, how he a different kind of consciousness begins to take over, almost a wild man type of consciousness. He said one time he did see a woodchuck, and he said, "If I could have caught it, I would have eaten it alive." He did indeed imagine himself to be living in the wilderness. Now, as an aside, he went home every weekend, and his mother did his laundry. But in Walden, he writes about things like devouring that woodchuck. And from these writings then emerges a cultural view of Thoreau as the champion of wilderness.
Yep. It sounds like he didn't like woodchucks much either.
He did, yeah. Well, he wanted to get one with them.
Oh,
see? Almost sort of a communion type experience. I mean, a sacramental type experience. I think this was involved with his level of interaction at sometimes with nature. And as he developed this encounter with wildness, and how many 10,000 Sierra Club posters have you seen, in wilderness is the preservation of the world? He developed this sacramental view of wildness and wilderness that then was, as it were, marketed to the rest of the country. And with that went a kind of notion of God and nature not just being very close, but something close to being identical. So that if you were going to commune with God, you really had to get into the wilderness. Now, maybe some of you here have written books in the wilderness. Maybe some of you have read a lot of books in the wilderness, and frequently you will hear, "This is where I find God." Not back home. Not in the 9-to-5. But when I'm out walking on the top of the ridge and I can feel the magnificence of the creation and so forth. So those are, you know, very plausible kinds of experiences that he had, but I just want to identify them for you. And again, with that commitment to the wilderness, to nature, went and sometimes unspoken, often spoken, anti-urbanism. Because vice is in the city. Virtue is in nature. And that means that the way you handle injustice is what he did with civil disobedience, is just to back away from it. To disconnect yourself from the machine, as he one time observed. Thoreau's attitude, it's worth saying, Thoreau's attitude toward the wilderness changed over the years. Walden is a pretty comfortable place to be. I mean, it's a little bit like walking down to the lake down here. It's all flat, and the, you know, the pathways and everything else, and you can imagine yourself being in the wild. But get off the trail at any place, and it's a little different. Well, Thoreau left Walden once, and or many times, as a matter of fact, and he took a trip to Maine, and he writes about this in his essay on Katahdin, Mount Katahdin, which is the I think the largest peak in Maine. And scholars of Thoreau have detected that after he came back from Katahdin, his view of the wilderness somewhat changed. Because what happened is that Thoreau went in the springtime, and he went up with a hiking party, but who he met along the way were the black flies. And if anybody knows, I don't know if you have black flies in this part of the world, but in Maine, they can drive you crazy. You know, I work in the garden, and I have to work wore netting around my head and everything else like this. Well, he encountered the black flies, and scholars have pretty much shown in his writing about the wilderness that subsequently the wilderness was a little more alien in his writings than it was before, as you see it in Walden or in his writings about his trips on the Merrimack River. All in all, to summarize Thoreau's point of view, I could maybe do it best from taking a statement that he makes in his essay on Cape Cod. Cape Cod, as you know, is this peninsula in Massachusetts, and he stood on the further easternmost side of Cape Cod and looked out at the Atlantic and the crashing seas, and many of you have been at that place, and the magnificence of the seas and the tides and everything else. And he said, "Here one can put the whole of America behind him." And that's what he basically wanted to do. He wanted to enter into the wilderness, be revived by the wilderness, and put the whole of civilization behind him. Now, let me just jump a couple more places, and then hopefully we can get into our discussion. Most of you know the name John Muir. How many know the name John Muir? Okay. John Muir was the great popularizer of the Thoreauvian tradition. To my mind, he is the best naturalist who has ever written anything. You can just sit down and read his works, The Mountains of California, Travels in Alaska, A Thousand-Mile Journey, any of these essays. It is just a magnificent writing description. If you want to get a sense for wildflowers in a glacial valley, read John Muir. He's a great stylist and someone who took Thoreau to the whole, to experience the whole country. I mean, his 1,000-mile walk was literally a 1,000-mile walk with, as he said, a couple biscuits in his pocket each time. And that's all he did. He I think he was also a little crazy. I mean, he tells of in the mountains of Sierra, he tells one time going out on this, he wanted to see a falls, and he went out on this cliff and just sort of, without any ropes or anything else, sort of tiptoed along without any footing to just see what it was like. Now, he did that many times. He went out in glaciers in Alaska, where one time he went on a glacier with Alaska and he lost his dog. His dog fell into a crevasse. Fortunately, the dog did it first and John Muir didn't have to do it. But he was that kind of a fellow, which reflects, as I read him, is not unlike Thoreau devouring the woodchuck. I mean, wanting to devour, you want almost to eat nature alive. It's a kind of a sacramental encounter. Now, John Muir was also one of the great champions, perhaps the great champion of the National Park Movement, which begins to tell another side of our American story and our theme, America the Beautiful. We heard some of these, the darker side, when we considered who discovered America. You've been hearing, at least in my tone of voice, if not in my discourse, some suggestions that maybe this anti-urbanism of this wilderness tradition is not the best thing for the country. One of the things that happened in the National Park Movement, not in all national parks, but in a number of them, is that in order to establish the national parks, you had to move the Native Americans out. Mm-hmm. That's a side of our national parks that we don't always think about. And that also reflects something was going on at the same time that Thoreau wrote, the same time that the Hudson River School was doing their paintings. How many knows the paintings of the Hudson River School? These Bierstadt, people like this, these canvases that are so big that show the glorious sun over the valleys and this marvelous, romantic view of the wilderness. The same time all this was going on in American history was also flooding over into the plains and out toward the coast by a doctrine historians called manifest destiny. So not only do you establish national parks and push out the Indians, but the whole movement of the society to go into the great promised land now becomes a movement of displacing and frequently executing whole native peoples and their cultures on an economy which, for most of the 19th century, which was predicated on slavery. So this new Eden now has its darker sides. And the theme of America, the beautiful, this land is my land, this land is your land, and this great sense for the richness of the wilderness brought with it a whole set of assumptions that people don't frequently like to think about in terms of the displacement of people the use of slaves and so forth. So John Muir popularized Thoreau, that most people who could read were taken in the 19th century and early 20th century were taken by this point of view. What I want to do, so as to allow us time for plenty of discussion, is now to fast forward from America, the New Eden, the purity of the wilderness over against civilization, the great vision of nature, the mountains, the plains, the oceans that John Muir had, fast forward to suburbia. After World War II, what began to happen in society? People now who read books, read people like John Muir and many others. I mean, Muir is a great stylist and a great naturalist, a great observer, but there are tens of thousands of other writers and magazines and in newspapers who are talking about how important it is to get back to nature, how dirty the city is. Some collections of poetry can positively make you gag in terms of the sentimentality of, I will walk, I wish I could cite them, I will walk in the country, not in the dirty streets of the city. So across the culture of those who did read and could read, as distinct from the immigrants and the slaves and so on, developed this sense of getting into the purity of nature. And this, as I read our culture, and you may want to take issue with this, after World War II became a marketing ploy for the whole society, driven by the automobile. What would be nicer than to get your automobile in order to go out into nature, to get away from the city where all those problems are? And you can imagine yourself there, you know, with your backyard barbecue, you know, really roughing it. And, you know, you even had the special equipment and everything else that went with it. And you made sure that it was very green, and there were also sort of nice trees planted around where you were, so that you could be at peace with nature and be close to the realities of nature. Never mind that this was a kind of a Disneyfied nature that you were in, but there was this whole movement, and with that also came a certain dark side. Frequently referred to as white flight. The persons of affluence, in order to get closer to nature, left the problems of the city behind. And, you know, cities that I know, like Cleveland and Boston and New York, I mean, what's going on with our public schools these days? You know, they're awful. What's going on with our suburban schools? They're wonderful. Except the ones that my kids went to, which are full of drugs and everything else, but never mind. But you get the point that this theme of America the Beautiful, which was so important for our culture, then became popularized and, from my point of view, taken over by a certain social ideology that is still causing problems in our society, because we still cannot handle our urban centers, and schools are one example. Another example would be what is sometimes called environmental racism. It's just an accident, isn't it, that the people who live near the dumps are mostly poor. It just happened that way. That many of the toxic waste site disposals are on Native American reservations or close there too. The United Methodist Church did a study 20 years ago that has now been cited frequently by scholars all over the place that pretty much demonstrated statistically that the places where pollution goes, the places where toxic anything goes, are in or next to poor communities. Why is it that the rate of asthma is 3 times higher in Harlem than it is in the suburbs? It just happens that way. Well, this is my worry about America. There's a kind of schizophrenia, a divided mind that goes on. There are all these wonderful values, and I love the wilderness, and I love to read Thoreau, and I love to read Muir. I love to take these old people's hikes that I take. And I grew up in suburbia. So, I mean, the suburbia people, my people. But I worry that the whole thing, the way it has been used in terms of social and economic structuring, has become like an ideology that keeps us in a place where we can't deal with the real social and environmental problems of this society. Okay, I'm going to leave that there as a still not beginning to answer this question, and I will save some time at the end, maybe 10, 15 minutes, when we can get into some drawing on some theological resources to see how we can maybe address what I consider to be the schizophrenia. But first of all, some of you have been giving me very quizzical looks, and at least two people, bless you, have been nodding your head yes. Tell me what questions you have, what objections you have, or what do you think that I have left out of the picture, as I surely have. Yeah.
Actually, I agree with your narrative, but I wanted to point out things like the unholy marriage of this notion of nature and of roads began even earlier, like around World War I. The first paved roads that were built in the U.S. outside of major cities were called parkways, which is a term that we still use for good reason, because they were landscapes, little nature-ridden, designed roads to go no more than a few miles outside of major cities. There are many, say, in Westchester County, mm-hmm. outside of New York. And they were designed explicitly with the bridges being too low for buses and public transportation to use them, so that only those who own private automobiles, a very minute percent mm-hmm. of the population at that time, could go and take this restorative drive mm-hmm. in the country. And these are roads which now, today, of course, are major transportation arteries.
The Bronx River Parkway.
Exactly. The Taconic State Park was an outgrowth. And other major cities had their own copies. Yeah.
And then, correct me if I'm wrong in this, but then Eisenhower picks up the same sort of set with the interstate highways, that this is the way to take us so that we can see the country.
And civil defense.
The model was one that began in this romanticized notion of experiencing nature, but that has been completely eclipsed by the utilitarian and, frankly, economic purpose for these roads. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a fascinating way of tracing that.
Yeah, I mean, one could do a history of the society, probably has been done. Study of the roads.
Right.
Asphalt Nation.
Yeah. Asphalt Nation. There you go. A book of that type. Yes.
Well, what do you make of the move back to cities now?
Yeah. It depends what move that you're talking about. I remember for 13 years, I was a chair of a board of a community organization in an inner city setting. And we had a convention, and people were lamenting what was going on in the community, and someone stood up and said, well, people are moving back into Asylum Hill. And we looked at each other and said, well, who's already here?
Right.
Now, if we're talking about gentrification, that's one thing. But if we're talking about things like the Nehemiah Project in New York that was put together by a Lutheran pastor and Johnny Ray Youngblad, the pastor of one of the great black churches in New York, we're talking about low-income housing and green spaces and things like that. That's another. What do you make of it? Where does your question come from?
I guess I'm thinking of Portland sort of becoming a city of that people are moving back to.
Is that stratified income-wise? I mean, or is
it? I don't really know. I know that the downtown area is becoming very popular as far as housing goes. I know there's still poor places in Portland, northeast, and they're poor. So I don't have the whole answer. I just know that there seems to be a movement back to cities, mm-hmm. like this Thoreau thing has sort of run its course.
Can anyone else chime in on this in terms of the,
architecturally, one of the big drives is to create lofts and condominiums out of these warehouse spaces. And it's happening in a lot of cities, mm-hmm. Dallas, Denver, places like that. From the income standpoint, these are not inexpensive places to live.
Yeah.
Right. This is not lower middle class or anything else.
Or affordable.
It's typically a lot of couples or people without children. And people who want to live near the urban centers where they work.
So they don't get caught in the traffic jam.
They don't get caught in traffic jam. They're closer, but by the same token, they've taken areas that are pretty decrepit, and in some cases vacant buildings standing unoccupied, mm-hmm. and turn them into something at least that makes the inner part of the city more vibrant than it
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm.
But
so it's a mixed blessing.
It's a mixed blessing, mm-hmm. and there may be, and I don't know, I'm studying, I don't know about the architectural thing going on. I don't know if that eventually bleeds off into help others who are already stuck there and can't leave.
One of the cities I know relatively well is Cleveland, Ohio, and there the inner ring of the suburbs is becoming, the same things happened to the inner ring of the suburbs that happened to the inner city a generation ago. So you have the gentrification movement inside, and now you have a ring of poverty in the first ring of suburbs. So it's just been the same story going on, but to the convenience of the people who don't have to get caught in the traffic jams.
Yes.
So I don't know, in terms of movement back to the city, how much of this is informed by a sort of a transformation and how much it is the same story being replayed. Yeah.
The same thing is happening in Seattle with condominiums in the downtown along the waterfront. Then a regrade area all the way down into Pioneer Square. What happens to the people that are being displaced?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody seems to want to really address that one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have the same kind of problem throughout that, the whole area, Western Park. For if we wanted to enlarge Friendship House,
mm-hmm.
there's an uproar among the neighbors. We don't want that much more in our neighborhood. I mean, it's always this kind of a battle between, we can't do something for someone without displacing somebody or putting somebody there that they don't want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a couple of comments. Your car, making suburbia more accessible. We've lived in several rural communities, and we've seen it from the back, the backflow of that, in the sense that car is really just, the automobile is really destroyed the rural community, mm-hmm. because everybody goes and does their businesses in the city and comes back into the country.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if there's another outer ring to the suburbia, and what we're experiencing is, people from Chicago, Madison, mm-hmm. the cities, coming in and buying farmland mm-hmm. for $10,000, $15,000 an acre,
displacing. They're displacing people who
have been displaced. It seemed like for a while there was this kind of a migration mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. some folks who thought it was easier to live cheaper out in the country. I think, you know, to displace people from the cities coming out trying to find them.
Let me tell you, since I have the floor, I can take the floor. Let me tell you about personal heresy that I have that gets me into trouble all the time. When I'm sort of on the circuit from time to time, and I talk to church groups and everything, and I can tell them that God is dead, I don't do that. I can tell them that promiscuous sex is fine, but I can't tell them that they got to give up their automobile. What really enrages people is to start talking about the automobile and how it is really the driving factor. How it is really not purpose, not how it is really the major factor that has shaped our cities. Think of Washington, D.C., and you can't move. You leave at 4 o'clock, and you get to work at 9 o'clock, and you're sitting in this parking lot. I mean, it has really shaped our whole city. But people, I start saying things like this, you know, and people say, well, how am I going to get the kids to soccer practice? How am I going to go shopping? And I think this is those of us in this group really got to put our heads together and say, we have to be able to interpret to people in our churches a different kind of vision, because if you preach all these things and they still drive their SUVs and they still the social policy is still oriented on more roads, and by the way, Amtrak's going under, and you know the buses stink and all the rest. What are we going to do? Have we made an impact from the point of view of the church?
Well, there's a little tiny bit of hope we live in Vancouver, Washington, which is across the river from Portland. And Portland, Oregon, has been doing a number of planned communities on light rail lines, which then help to cut down the need for cars. Maybe they need to get their car to the light rail stop, and then they don't need to take it into town. And in some of these planned communities, they're actually looking at mixed use so that it includes affordable housing plus some of the richer ones like they're talking about in Seattle along the waterfront. I know there's some of this happening in Seattle. There was a big affordable housing conference in Seattle. There was just one in Vancouver. And some of the people that gave presentations, it was quite exciting how they could build houses close together, keep a park in the middle, so there was still a place for children to play, and cut down the roads even, you know, to get into this thing, and then light rail close enough to get you. Mm-hmm. Now, this is all positive, and it's hopeful, and yet every time these things happen, people are mad. Because in the Portland area, there are a lot of the people that don't like it because they think they're being told what to do. Uh-huh. But it is happening.
Maybe I could put the question this way. Let's imagine that I'm a preacher and you're the congregation, and I know a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. Okay, now what am I going to say to you guys that addresses the automobile, that addresses the need for us to have some sort of social planning so that we incorporate low-income housing and so that we deal with waste disposals in a way that doesn't dump on poor communities? What should the preacher be telling you all?
I'm not sure. I'm a little suspect of your wanting to get rid of cars. I think you might as well just go beat yourself against the head against the wall. That's not going to happen. So,
okay.
I mean, I guess I'd be more interested in practical solutions. Like, I would say a good solution for affordable housing and getting people thinking about affordable housing and connecting with poor people would be getting your congregation connected with Habitat or you know, doing something rather than be getting up in front of the congregation and preaching about
cars are your problem.
Cars are your problems and houses. Here's
this positive alternative that we want to support.
Now,
Go ahead.
I mean, I disagree. I mean, I think that the reason that people moved to suburbia, I think, is not because they were reading the writings of John Muir. It was because they had no choice. I mean, I was raised in suburbia, too, and maybe things are different now, but you look back like 20 years ago, and you were starting a family, and you needed a place to live. The market only offered you a suburban
new place to live. And that's not by accident. I mean, I'm one of these people who believes it's conspiracy, right, by corporate America. I mean, they make a lot of money, and suburbia is basically subsidized. I actually think it's caused more by people who are unlearned, right, because they don't realize that they're really kind of getting ripped off here, right, because the people in the city are actually subsidizing this sprawl out into suburbia, because they vote for every bond issue. I mean, unfortunately, at least in Texas, every road bond issue that comes up, there's no question that whether or not it's going to pass. And so they're basically saying, you know, spending their money to propagate this.
We're
so
used to come to Oregon, we don't vote for that stuff.
Right. If we all move to Oregon.
All we need to do is cut off the gasoline supply.
Or at least make the price of gasoline
realistic,
more accurately reflect the real price of gasoline in the rest of the world. Right on.
And factor in social costs, health costs, and everything else from pollution.
Electric cars and things like that.
Okay.
That are so
we want to talk about positive solutions. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask you to give up your car, because I'm not going to ask myself to give up my car, but I sort of think you have to say no as well as saying yes. You have to say, if you're going to say yes and give these positive examples, you have to say what's wrong. And now that'll get people riled. And so you have to be real judicious about it, but I sort of think you have to do the analysis and say that look what our things have come to. Yes?
Well, I was just going to mention SUVs. The enormous cars that people are driving, mm-hmm. often only back and forth to work,
mm-hmm.
That might be a place to start, rather than saying give up your car, to take a look at what kind of a mm-hmm. car that you're driving.
Maybe have a study group in your church.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where they would come, but
a movement.
Yes.
I think also Americans, because we're so independent-minded, particularly on days like today, don't like to be told what we can't do, but we do respond well to a positive vision that's laid out before us of what could be, what might be, and what the implications of changing our current behavior are likely to be. And even as difficult as it is,
uh-huh.
a positive vision that says here's what might be and here's what we have to do to get there is always Americans have responded pretty well to that. If you can find somebody to elaborate on what that vision looks like and how we can possibly get there, not some impossible dream that's conceivably unattainable, but something that is attainable,
okay.
And then give people positive incentives. And one of them is to, frankly, raise the price of gasoline just to what it is in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from that standpoint, we live in sort of an artificial world.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the brother speaks well here, because now we can make a transition into the vision, okay? My sense is that we got to step even one step backward with this vision and have what is the overall arching theological vision, and then come up with some middle axioms to translate that in. Maybe gasoline policy, it may be legislating greater efficiency for fuel. I mean, that's a huge source of energy that we don't tap and so forth. What is this theological vision? Let me just hang something up for you to look at now. It's my belief as a Bible-carrying Christian that the Bible does not suffer from this schizophrenia of the wilderness and nature and city life. There are some of the elements at various places. The prophet Amos doesn't think much of city folks who are mostly wealthy and so forth. He's very much concerned about agrarian folks. The Yahwistic writer who does Genesis 2 and so forth really comes from an agrarian point of view and has is not very happy with the rise of the monarchy and David and so forth. But overall, it seems to me that the biblical vision, if you take it to the very end, is a vision of a holistic vision where civilization and nature live in a truly a peaceable kingdom. That is, what we are looking forward to is a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. That's in Peter, or in Book of Revelation, the New Jerusalem, Revelation 21, in the setting of a new heaven and a new earth. So that the biblical vision at the end is of a vibrant living city in the midst of a renewed world. And I take that all the way back to the beginning, that God creates a world where all creatures are to have a place, not just human creatures. And if we have this vision and then factor in the key element, which is righteousness or justice, so that we can start talking about eco-justice with the New Jerusalem and the new heavens and earth before us as our vision as to where we're going, where this whole universe is going, and that then becomes our guiding light for sort of working through and coming up with policies and procedures and political directions here and now. That, just to state it flatly, I believe that God wants a world in which there's wilderness. I believe that God wants a world in which there are people who work the land and who are close to the land and can do so in a living way, not necessarily agribusiness people. And I believe that God creates a world of human community where people gather, where there's a meaningful place for city life. I think that those sort of second level axioms can be translated out of the whole biblical vision. And then you get to the need, if I'm right in this, that is fabricated nature, cultivated nature, and wild nature, city, farm, and wilderness. If that's the world that God created and God is going to redeem, then how, where all creatures share justly in the commonwealth of God's good earth, then what are going to be some of those middle axioms that we struggle to find that will be the basis for policy? That I would hang that out there for you as a vision that the church has to bring to American society, which is still very much, in my reading of it anyway, schizophrenic, where a lot of the nature writing is highly romantic and is really forgetful of, if not despising of urban life. Do we have possibilities for that? Let me ask you this question. Is that a translatable vision from your point of view, or do we need to go in a different direction?
I'd say not without a lot of pain.
Excuse me?
I'd say not without a lot of pain.
A lot of pain. Tell me more.
There's going to have to be some major things happening, because people are not going to ever agree among themselves to cut back on the automobile or to cut back on this or anything else, or provide the taxes. There has to be something happen. I don't know what it is.
Okay.
But it's going to be painful, whatever it is.
Do you know any...
Into a frame of mind that, hey, let's get together and cooperate.
Okay.
We're not about to do it right now.
Do you know of any community which is sort of organized around taking up the cross?
Not to my knowledge.
Oh. Does anybody know of any community that's organized up to take up the cross to experience the pain?
No.
Hopefully the church, you guys. Man, I got to write home to my mother about this class. Do you know what? I asked. And do you know what they said? I sometimes have this fantasy of the church being can be analogous to Alcoholics Anonymous, only it's Consumer Anonymous, you know, that we get together and when someone wants to buy a big ticket item, we talk each other out of it. You know, is it possible for the church to be a kind of an exemplary community?
I think that's a good idea, Paul, but I think I'd start at it a little bit differently because you're starting with the conclusion, and maybe we can back off one step and talk about the need for human beings to understand themselves as limited and human communities as limited, that not to, and that the church, I think, can help its members understand what we're not entitled to. And then that translates out into specific circumstances. So if you take cars as an example, some people are in circumstances where they don't need a car or where they only need one in their household, and other people aren't. So other people make different kinds of decisions, but I think what's in common, and as a teacher of college students, more and more what I'm saying to myself is what I have to offer them is to help them think about how, when to live within limits and when to push the limits. But not to tell them the old refrain, every little boy can be president, you can be anything you want to be, you can have everything.
That's the graduation speech that they all hear. You have unlimited possibilities.
And to a certain extent, and we know ways in which that's true, but you can't have everything at once. And you know, Paul says all things are lawful, but not all things are good. So to think about that and how we make faithful decisions rather than starting in the church with laws about what the right decisions are.
Okay, a more nuanced view perhaps, Beth?
Well, I was thinking about wilderness as something that is able to teach that very lesson. People don't like everything that Edward Abbey has written, but that seems to be one of the things that he's discovered, is human limitation, in the real sense of that being in the grand expanse of wilderness with the black flies that says, you are not all, and you do have limits. And it seems to me that the Deuteronomy text has strains of that that we're using for the theme verse, of remember that, you know, you don't live by bread alone. You were disciplined out there, and you were like a child, but you were still sustained. And do you find hope that wilderness could teach us lessons other than kind of training?
Well, I do, because that's been my experience. Okay. At the same time, historically, there is this phenomenon in the life of the churches that the way to deal with urban problems is to take inner city kids to the wilderness. And now that may be great in a certain sense, experience, but they still got to go back.
And their schools still suck.
So this kind of thing can be important in terms of lifestyle and learning limits and that kind of thing, but somehow we have to deal with the other issues too. Boston, it was for many years, it was busing, and everybody thinks pretty much it was a disaster, but at least people were making an effort to try to do something about this. Yeah.
Well, Holden Village is a little bit of an example that's good for people. As I was going around the village and hearing people get ready for the 4th of July, I heard one lady down in the sewing room down there who was making a decoration for something, and she said, oh, this is so much more fun. If I were home, I'd go to the store and I'd buy something that I needed to decorate. And this is so much fun. People don't think about that at home as much. And this reminds you of it when you're here, how much fun it is to make do.
Okay, exemplary community. Okay, wilderness is part of this. But I would say, now that we're talking about where we are, I just had an enormously good experience, not just taking all these hikes, but going on the operations tour yesterday. and to see how, you have to bring in some diesel fuel. You have to burn some wood. But at the same time, you're doing all these other things, not flushing so much, and all those kinds of things that make this a much more sustainable community, and, by the way, a more humane community where people have fun and they're not always in a traffic jam.
That's true.
You know? So exemplary.
Here's an idea for the confirmation class. You should take them on a tour of the sewage plant.
Yeah, that happened to me in the third grade. But I don't know why some visionary teacher took us to the sewage plant.
But see, I think this is one of the.
And the concept that goes with this that I learned way back when someone said throw it away, and then someone else said there is no away. Yes.
Maybe part is also to educate kids, maybe turn that spin that message of you can be anything and go anywhere in school, and go back to what you talked about earlier in class, from till and keep to serve and protect, to help kids understand that there are consequences for anything that you choose to do, and that maybe part of creating this vision for the future is to understand the implications of decisions that get made, and to make sure they understand their role and their part in that. And the church can be a very big part of that in taking the message beyond Sunday when we go home to what do we do on Monday, in applying it to everyday lives. What part can each of us play? Even though we may consider ourselves insignificant individually, what part can we play in striving for this vision for a more effective community, for reducing the amount of the utilization of cars, for increasing mass transportation, or for dealing with other environmental issues as well?
Amen. And I think I want to have the last word, and that is I want to put a plug in for Holden Village. And I want to put a plug in for the outdoor ministries of the church all over this country, many of which are doing extraordinary works of education, dealing with these kinds of issues. I mean, here we are in the midst of the wilderness talking about these kinds of issues. My hunch is that is not what the preacher is going to say in the pulpit so much, because I've been doing that for 35 years, and I don't know how many people listen, but it's not going to be in the 45 minutes of Sunday school on Sunday, or even the confirmation class where you have these souped up adrenaline kids learning not an awful lot, but it's going to be in experiences like this where you can really learn something and then get mutual support and then go back, strengthen that way to build communities like this where you live and where you work and in your church. Be subversive in your church and establish a Holden mini cell. You know, my guess is that the hope for the church is with these alternative type communities that then influence, infiltrate into ordinary, so-called ordinary parishes. As long as we keep the vision as to where we're going, and as long as we overcome our America schizophrenia. Thank you very much for coming today.
Trap. Fewer children.
A generation.
You can accomplish what the events, so-called events, society that we point to and say, this is good. Singapore accepting their somewhat authoritarian religions. Sweden, certainly Japan, although they have their
awareness
in terms of their concepts and
wait.
Certainly, Detroit didn't. This would be something much more inflammatory for the church to propose.
Hey,
well, have two kids, we've sort of done this. Where the population is growing is immigrant population in the Catholic Church. It's not in the middle of the road.
That may be true.
We're staying much closer to the rest of the population. I've been to Harlem, which is undergoing the Renaissance. Through gentrification, population explosion is going to be very recent with the disaffected portion of the community. If all those people instantaneously as parents could be transferred to the middle class cities, they'd never get ahead because the rate of appropriation is so high that it robs them.
Well, this is a whole other issue.
But issues of consumers and rural people, they're a plebiscite. Have fewer kids.
I would call that one of the plebiscites.
Because
I've been listening for something. I just recently came back to their church after 20 years. I've kind of formulated a real reason to keep it. Very interesting environment. Let me hear something. I want to hear it. It's not preached heavily on the church. But
I would say in excess of 75% of goods you see there are by China. That's in China. Convert this mass surplus of liberated labor in China into blanket exploitation. China is a willing participant in feeding their sensation of human appetite.
Straight to the heart of it.
Okay, well, let me.
Let me take this. Could you, with the effort that you can support their lifestyle? You can't produce your automobile and all that junk. I mean, somebody.
Either guy come up with $100,000 to buy their house. I established a relationship with a banker that trusts me to cough up the $100,000 to buy my house. And then they trust me to pay that every month. Certainly, that you're right. I think that's non sequitur. Certainly, I'm not sure I manufactured my drive.
Okay, then let's put it this way. You're saying that one state is not exploiting anyone?
No. Blanket statements are. I think that just shuts off.
Why are there lakes in Mara Gordas south of the Texas border? I mean, these people aren't begging to be walked on by industry.
Trust me, they're begging to get those jobs. As badly as they're treated. You can speak to my sister who lived in Laredo for 12 years. As badly as they're treated, as awful as the things that Ford is doing to those employees, by local standards, by Mexican standards, they're fighting to get better jobs, even at the dollar level, because the alternative is working in the fields. That's a fact. That's not my opinion. They're fighting against those people.
So there is one thing we did talk about today. Let me just tell you the population. My understanding of the population is that it's a fact. As far as I know, the only proven way to curtail population is twofold. One, economic development and educational. Those two things, if that's done, then population growth stops, okay? So that, then we raise the question of economic development, education, and revenue. And how is that going to happen? And that raises the stabilization question. It's very complicated.
Everything's complicated.
Yeah, it is. But if you have no simple answer,
if you take this approach of if you toss a pebble in a pond and the ripples get larger and larger, and you start dragging in peripheral issues. Then the local solution that you ask the audience, if I understood it properly, what can the church do? It becomes lost in the background noise. You and I and us in this whole village are not going to do anything to curtail the expansion of avaricious capitalism that's going on in China. China's undergoing a wholesale conversion to avaricious consumerism, just like we went through in the post-war 50s.
I disagree with that.
It's happening. I mean, the manufacturing of our cars and refrigerators and all the middle-class accoutrements in China is happening in a tidal wave fashion. Agrarian lifestyle is no longer being supported by a central government in China or in Russia. There's no more collectivization of farms in Russia. Poof, that's gone. People don't have that option. The government's not providing that option.
So come back to the center on this. Tell me about the church.
Yes. Well, the church could browbeating people, not browbeating, trying to morally coerce people to be more modest consumers and not buy an SUV, when in reality, having a smaller family will accomplish those same goals.
Might have a difficult time finding that in the gospel.
Well, no doubt. That's why I raised the issue, because how would you...
I think folks already have a smaller family. Our middle-class families are getting smaller and smaller. The ones that are getting bigger in this country are the immigrant families from the South, from Latin America. And that's why the Catholic Church is growing. And that whole population thing has to be dealt with in this country, by the Catholics in this country, but the WASPs, our population is way down. In fact, I think it's, it's approaching something close to equity.
Yeah.
And
replacement.
Yeah, we're replacing ourselves, but we're our consumption level continues to go up, and that's where I mean. That's a statistic that I think you got to deal with, if I might say so, and that is that we consume, 40% of the world's resources with 20% of the world's population, or 5% of the world's population.
Yeah.
And that's a thing we have to
statistics
address.
Like that are again, they're shaded with prejudice, because we also, the United States generates 90-odd% of all pharmaceutical patents in the whole world. We educate in the United States, educates 90-odd% of all the electrical engineers in the entire Western world. Those are not experts, strictly speaking.
But to consume
raw materials.
We do. I mean, this education process is not consuming the raw materials. It's this development.
Well, you're saying we deserve this because we educate these people. Is that your statement? I didn't understand. So why do we deserve to consume orders of magnitude more than the rest?
Because much of that is redistributed to the benefit of the larger world. We're feeding, for instance, for better or worse, what you think of mega agriculture as practiced in this United States. We're feeding the preponderance of the world right now. We're shipping out of Seattle grain that feeds the Fifth Navy or whatever is in Vladivostok, Russia. They'd be starved. This is a matter of record.
Okay, and then what is it that you want in return for this?
What is it we want in return?
Right. We deserve something because we're shipping this food out?
Right now.
We deserve SUVs.
No, I didn't say that.
Then I don't understand what the point you're making.
Well, to say that we consume resources out of proportion to our population is not to recognize that much of what we consume is re-exported.
Well, that's being counted. Those people, the Russian Navy, is consuming that wheat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we're consuming orders of magnitude more than they're consuming.
Yeah. That's the point.
That the Russian Navy is not part of that consumption.
That's right.
Figure.
It's part of what?
I say.
Oh yeah.
The
I'm
Russian
saying, I'm
Navy
saying,
is not part of the consumption figure.
But yeah. They're figured in the whole world's consumption. When we take us as 40%, the other percentage is what we ship to the Russian Navy and everybody else. I'm saying. I still haven't heard a reason why we should have orders of magnitude more consumption than the rest of the world.
I got to go.
Right on.
Hamburger time. Hamburger time. It's time to consume.
That's right. You're kind of worried about yourself. You're back in the church now, and you're not hearing stuff. Thanks. That's a good conversation. What are you going to do? I mean, I don't want to lose you in the church.
Well, because you know... I guess I learned this from my father. It's like the same reason I don't want to move further out, like the road. That's why that kind of makes me change. Is, well, you know, nothing's going to happen until the people there stay and try. I'd love to move to Oregon, right? But I live in Texas, right? I would love to try to make some change there and to go to Oregon, right? So, you know, I don't know. My pastor was sitting on the other side of the room as far as made the statement. But, yeah, I mean, I walked to the church parking lot, and we're not talking about just SUV, we're talking four excursions, a very big swarm. And I'm saying, I'm supposed to be in a community of people, it's supposed to be a Christian community. And is this what the Christian community is? I am definitely not a part of this community. I mean, I'm driving a Ford Escort with a Nader sticker on the back of it. And you know, it's a suburban, well-to-do area of Austin. So I was like, I don't know the answer. You know, I'm not.
Are there other Christians that share your point of view that you know?
I'm still trying to figure that. Not that I've had a personal conversation with that. No one has. Hasn't come out.
We need to put you in touch with other people. I mean, this is one thing in my experience that is sustained. We got a piece of this vision the new heavens and the new earth, and that has implications for how we live here now. But
Where
you can say out
the spirit of the whole
world, you know, I always have to say
speech, but
it's 50,000 student university and a million person town. When I knew there,
we're the Saturday Night Live. It's always
back in the days. Thank you. Tell me your name. Mark. I know I met you at Edvin and
Christians who just got to the very colleges and so forth.
And I read Paul's little bio. You guys were at Trinity.
When you go to the
my professor is a pastor in Cleveland Heights and has been for years.
You may find out that there are other
Oregon
Recital
Association. What church are you a member of?
I've known a number of people. Was it from Ken Milano who were
support for the things that you care about? Because going to the Lord is.
We were only there.
But you were there at some
what
of my
I would
parents
like to do also is along the way. Let me give them a card. If you need someone to talk to you about the SUV, be in touch with me, and maybe there's someone, if I put my mind to it, in the Austin area, would be interested in these kinds of things, and would be able to sort of complement some of the interests that I'll put you in touch with. What's your name?
Paul Crocker.
Paul Crocker.
Nice to meet you. I'm very much enjoying it. I really appreciate the depth you seem to have, you know, with all the background ratings and everything. I really like that. As I was telling my wife, I said, I wish we had something like this at the church. You know, someone that could fit all this depth and, you know, distill it into something.
Well, thank you. Okay. Be in touch if you want to.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It's not so good.